Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Entrepreneurs and Century Wealth Management.
In this podcast, we'll have a series of interviews with accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm Pearson Crutcher.
And I'm Jay Healy. Pearson runs the Society of Entrepreneurs. It's a membership organization founded to promote Memphis entrepreneurship and provide education and resources to business owners.
Jay Healy is the founder and president of Century Wealth Management, an entrepreneurial firm that can serve as your family's CFO. There are so many great entrepreneurs in Memphis, and their stories need to be told. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. Today we have our guest, Susan Stevenson, the co-founder and co-chair of Independent Bank. We hope that you'll enjoy hearing about her entrepreneurial journey, her career in banking, and her enthusiasm for helping others succeed. Welcome, Susan Stevenson. We're so excited to have you today on our podcast, Entrepreneurial Insights. Susan is the co-chair and president of Independent Bank, and I'm really excited to hear more about your entrepreneurial journey, the bank, and how y'all are dealing with COVID and all kinds of things. So let's get this conversation going.
Yeah. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much.
Excited to have you here. So for those who don't know about Independent Bank, give us the big picture explanation of what the bank does.
Well, goodness, we are now a 22-year-old local financial institution. We opened our doors in 1998. We are a privately owned company that is truly hyper-focused on our community that we serve. In the years that we've been in business, we have focused on being a full-service financial institution. We have expertise in all the different areas that would serve our community, from banking individuals to commercial organizations to commercial real estate organizations. We have business in the indirect auto space, which has been part of our company since we started. But truly, we're a local financial institution that serves the community in every way that financial institutions can do so. We have a mortgage department and we have a wealth management division within our company. So we are a full service bank. And I'd like to say, from a character of our organization, perhaps it's defined by the fact that we are very relational in all of our interactions with our customers. We have built a long process that has been focused on getting and keeping relationships. And so our focus has been hyper-relational. We are about building something more than just a transaction with everyone, but instead getting to know people and understanding what it is they need from us and what we can do to help them achieve their goals. Because at the end of the day, a bank is a part of your tool chest that allows you to do the things that you're dreaming of doing. And so my job is to do whatever it is you need me to do.
Yeah. So that's a great explanation of where you are. Now we want to ask you how you got there. So tell us about the journey of starting as an entrepreneur and what that was like.
Well, first of all, did you grow up in Memphis?
I did not. Actually, I was born in the carpet capital of the world, Dalton, Georgia. My father was an engineer by training and actually was involved in the carpet business very early on and did some patenting that allowed carpets to dry rolled carpet at a time so that you got a consistent color. We moved to Chattanooga when I was very young, and so I grew up in Chattanooga. I moved to Memphis in 1979. I thought this was going to be a brief stay. I had followed my first love here, who was going to graduate school. And as fate would have it, I fell out of love with my first love and in love with Memphis. And it's been home for me. So I'm not a native Memphian, but most people from Memphis think that I've been here forever because I'm now so old that I have been here for a very long time. But it's also, aside from the accent, which is even people from Memphis make fun of the way I talk. So yeah, I do, in fact, have a little bit of that East Tennessee twang that rears its ugly head.
Oh, I'm very fond of the East Tennessee twang.
There you go. I think it is. It is. When, you know, God lives in East Tennessee, I've been to his house.
I think you're right. Where did you go to college?
I actually went to University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. At the time that I started, it was University of Chattanooga. It was acquired by the university system. So I graduated from college in 3 years and then did some postgraduate work. I had originally planned, as we talk about our journey, I have read that when we make plans, God laughs, and apparently he found me really entertaining and very humorous because I have done absolutely nothing that I expected to do in my journey. I had planned to go to law school after a short period of time, and I majored in history and English after spending enough hours. I had enough hours to be a biology major as well. At one point, I had considered going to med school, but I found that I'm uniquely ill-suited temperamentally for what the folks who were trying to train me told me were bad outcomes. And bad outcomes in medicine are worse than bad outcomes in many other places. And so
for sure,
I like happy endings, and I found that I was not going to have them every day in medicine. So I pivoted, thought that I would go to law school, came to Memphis. Economic reality dictated that I get a job. And I had been teaching. I was certified to teach, and I was actually arrived in Memphis in the early weeks of September of 1979. And Memphis schools actually started earlier than they started in East Tennessee. So I went to the city school board, applied for a job, and the woman who was there looked at me and said, I was 21 years old. And as noted, I had a very deep East Tennessee twang. And she looked at me, and the only job opening was in a high school where the teacher that she was seeking to replace, they had taken the wheels off that teacher's car and placed it on top of a dumpster. And she looked at me and she said, honey, they would eat you up. You need to go get you a real job. I said, okay. So I had a good friend who took my resume to First Tennessee Bank. And I interviewed for their management training program, and they were generous enough to hire me and spent a lot of years teaching me what I needed to know so that I could become, in fact, a banker, a real one, in a place that I truly loved. So it's been a career that was unexpected and unplanned. And in fact, the one career that I thought I would never pursue, my mother was a banker and actually one of the very first women who had been elected to position of bank officer in her company. And my observation of bankers was that they worked many long hours and they seemed to never completely finish whatever task they were working on. And I thought that looked fairly tedious. And so I didn't think that would be an area I would pursue.
Interesting. And it turned out to be your journey.
It is. In fact, I have a job that I love. Absolutely. I've had a chance to do almost every different area inside of a financial institution. And it is a great joy to have a chance to help solve a problem for someone or help accelerate their success or create a path for someone else to pursue their own dreams. And if you think about what we do every day, I have a chance to, in the morning, I can go to an industrial site and look at a build that's about to take place that's going to be transformative. I can then, at lunchtime, go talk to a person who's in the service industry and solving problems for someone there. And after lunch, I can go have a conversation with someone who is looking for a way to finance their dream home or pay for their daughter's wedding or help a child go to college. And so you have a chance to variously experience so many different things. So it's a great, great place to have spent 42 years of my life now.
And you also, you said, okay, you started in a management training program.
I did.
But then you started Independent Bank. So can you talk about some, how you got to the point where you actually started a new bank, which is a huge undertaking?
You know, it's really interesting because I have, whenever you're in an organization, all of us have experienced that feeling of, I think I know a better way. This seems like perhaps this is great, but I might do it differently if I were given that opportunity. And I had had a chance over the course of my career in banking to as I said, do lots of different jobs. And ultimately, I had a chance to run the Tennessee organization for Boatman's Bank Shares. And Boatman's Bank Shares was a really interesting and very large financial institution at the time in the country. In fact, we were one of the top 15 financial institutions in the United States. But we were grandfathered into multiple states, which was at the time not an option for financial institutions. And so they ran the organization as different individual, separately chartered financial institutions. So I had a chance to run the Tennessee Bank for Boatman's Bank Shares. And that job was absolutely challenging and exciting and interesting. And I actually thought, I love what I'm doing. I love the people that I'm doing it with. We were, however, acquired by Nations Bank, which ultimately became Bank of America. And their process for running an organization was very different from the Boatman's process. They had a lot of centralization of tasks. They had a different construct for their approach to every market that they served. And so it became clear to me that the part of the job that I truly loved was having a chance to solve problems and to innovate and to really have an impact on the process. And my sense at my new organization was that I was the most expensive decorative object in the building, which is not very satisfying. So my business partner and I, Chip Dudley, and I have worked together for almost all of the 42 years that I've been in banking. And we had a conversation and were feeling similarly challenged by our new circumstance. And we made a decision that for all the years of our lives, we had actually talked about starting a bank long before we actually acted on the idea. And when we visited with each other, we said, if not now, when? And if not the two of us, we're prepared. We've had opportunities to do the things that we need to do to know how to do this. So we made a decision that maybe that was the next path for us to follow. So we actually knew at the time that Boatman's was acquired, we created an opportunity for us. It created a financial event for both of us that allowed us to have some options about what would we do. And we both made the decision to take all of our resources and put our money in first and build a financial institution. And frankly, we at one point thought about not being a bank. We thought about doing something else that we might be good at. And a critical moment in that process, we had a conversation with an advisor who looked at us and said, I have a question for you. Like, you've both been in banking for your entire careers and you're interested in starting something and you want to have it be a great success. Why don't you do something you know something about? So,
good advice.
Yeah. It was very good advice. So we did decide to start Independent Bank, and we were very fortunate. We actually met, and this is a true story, we met for lunch. At the time, Chip was running Boatman's Bank in Arkansas, and a very big, largest financial institution in the state of Arkansas. And he drove over to Memphis, and we were seated at a table. And as it happened, it had paper tablecloths, the paper topper on it. And so we were both writing out numbers. And as folks who were in the financial space do, we were thinking about the math and how would this work. And so as we were writing numbers and really having an intense conversation with each other, we were observed by one of our former friends and a former director that had worked with both of us. After we finished our meeting, we get a phone call. And the phone call was, okay, are you two guys up to something? And we said, well, I don't know. We're kind of thinking about what might be next. And he said, well, if you're up to something, I'm in.
Wow.
And we said, well, we really don't know what that means yet. And he said, well, I'm in. And about 45 minutes later, the phone rings again, and it's another phone call from a person who'd had a conversation with that person. And he said, I hear y'all are up to something. And we said, well, we're thinking about it. We're on a path to being up to something. We don't know exactly what. And they said, I'm in.
And that's amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
As fate would have it, we ended up raising our initial equity without ever hiring anyone to help us with that process from people who knew us and knew us well.
Wow, that says a lot about y'all's reputation, that's for sure.
Yeah. Did you have a clear vision for what you wanted to build?
At the core of who we are as a mission for our organization, our goal is to serve our community and our customers and our coworkers heroically. And so we started with a foundation that was this notion of being good is not good enough, that we wanted to be extraordinary.
Do you mind if I write that down?
That is very good. Very good.
You know, everyone says it, but I will tell you there's a part of me that everyone knows that our mantra is to serve heroically. I mean, it's in our mission statement, and it's such a grand idea. But when I say to you that we do that, I have example after example. I've got customers who will tell you that they've called from a far-flung one customer who called and said, look, my child is in Australia on the side of the road with a credit card that's not working because they've exhausted their limit and they're trying to get a place to stay at night and I need your help. And oh, by the way, it's not your credit card, which made it a little bit harder. But we did have a chance to call a friend of ours at the bank who had issued the card and we got some help for him and got him into a hotel. And we have gone to retrieve a debit card from an ATM in the middle of the night for a young couple that was getting ready to leave on their honeymoon. And when Hurricane Elvis hit Memphis, we closed home equity loans by candlelight. And we have a real sense of what a privilege it is to do what we do for the people we do it for. So it does sound really corny and everybody says it, Jay. And I know that when I say it, I have to say there's a part of our secret to our success, which is we're over a $1 billion bank now without benefit of ever making an acquisition, which is unusual. The first of a bank that's done that for a long time in our community. And we're sort of simple, doing the basics really well, but getting and keeping customers. And for those of you who you know how hard it is to do that, to develop relationships and sustain them over a long arc of time. But I think what makes us different is our team. And those are people who are, I guess we've sort of found a way to replicate the DNA of who we are. And I will tell you that there's no question that if I have hard conversations with my team members, it's usually my team members are advocating passionately for their customer, and we're trying to find the balance in that process. So we are fortunate to have an idea of who we are that we share collectively, and it's to try to be a little bit different.
How do you find those people, your team?
You know, it's really interesting, Pearson, because I think that in the universe, like attracts like, and so there's a little bit of this that our team members refer their friends and former coworkers. And we are very fortunate to have long tenured team members, but we also have people who say, I know you, I know your branch manager at this location. I think I have a person who's a perfect fit for you. And very frequently they're right, because once you understand what you're trying to do again and again, and you're consistent about it, you're fortunate. I will tell you that I say all the time, the most at every individual tipping point level, we have a series of values that we try to instill in folks. And I think that those sort of guiding principles become core to who we are. And folks that understand those values and share those values, they feel comfortable and safe and elect to stay. And the people who don't really love that standard probably select out.
Yeah. It's not uncommon that a company, entrepreneurs have a mission, vision, value written down somewhere. Maybe it's on the board in the conference room. But I think it is unusual to really, as you said, get it into the DNA of every team member. So what do you actually do to spread that culture, get engagement and get the results that you're looking for.
You know, that's the sort of thing that I think comes down to the only thing that really ever sticks. And I found this with both my children and with my coworkers and everybody I've found in life. Modeled behavior is about the only thing that ever makes people believe this is what we really are supposed to do. So I will tell you that I look to all the people who are serving in important places in our company. They are demonstrating every day that we mean this customer is the center of our universe. And being customer-centric is a lot more work than being company-centric. And the people who model that every day are the people who are at the moment of interaction to see that and to embrace it and truly to day after day in the hard days. I will tell you, in the pandemic, I've had a chance to really see character exposed everywhere because you see how committed people are to making things work, how willing they are to adjust time and schedule and truly be sacrificial in their approach to what they do to serve a greater good. And I see that kind of servant leadership that's modeled across our company all the time. And people look out for their customers and they look out for each other. And I think that that modeled behavior is, we do have on desks across our organization, if you walk into one of our branches, you'll see our mission statement, our values on most people's desks, which is a lovely thing. But I think that if it were just written instead of experienced, it wouldn't make very much difference. And we'd still have to work really hard to get it right every day. Mm-hmm. I don't go to bed thinking, man, another perfect day. That would be awesome.
Well, I was just going to ask you, what has been the biggest challenge of growing your business? Would you say it's the current environment with COVID, or what was your biggest challenge?
I have never experienced anything like this pandemic. We have survived, and I tell people all the time, we started the bank in 1998, and at some point for a shareholders meeting, I did a survey, and it turns out that a staggering number of the most significant financial disasters have occurred in our tenure. And just to go down the path, we opened the doors in 1998, the dot-com bubble burst. So if you think about the dot-com bubble, had a ripple effect through lots of different areas. We then had 9/11, which in our particular space, because we were dealing directly with consumers, had a significant impact, and followed by the recovery and then the Great Recession. And the Great Recession being followed by this experience of pandemic, I will tell you what's been the most difficult for me. I would suggest that if you asked my business partner, he would say the same. Financially, though, we're having an extraordinary year. We really, early in this disaster, addressed what we thought were our greatest risk points. We were very proactive about doing that. And so we're having an extraordinary financial year. But in terms of what has been challenging from a perspective of leadership, this is an isolating experience. If you think about what happened after 9/11, we gathered together. It was like the best of us was exposed. We were kind to each other. We were solving each other's problems. We were reaching out. I had the sense of community in a way that I've never experienced it. In the heart of the Great Recession and even beyond, we were all sensitive to how do we do this, but we were talking to each other and able to be together. The thing that's tough about this pandemic, while, as I said, we're having an extraordinary year in terms of performance, is that this is I can't pick up the phone and go call on a prospect because people are trying to avoid exposure. So it's difficult to go find new people to tell your story to and to invite them in. It's difficult. It's not impossible, but that's a part of the challenge. But I also think it's making sure that you take care of people's mental health, because this is a time when people are more than any other time in my lifetime, I have people who are simultaneously doing their job, trying to educate their children at home, dealing with the issues of family members who may be impacted by the pandemic or isolated from others because of the pandemic. And so it's just a very different emotional setting.
Yeah.
Really, really is. You can't make the connections over Zoom that you can in person, can you?
You cannot. I am, as I have said to you earlier, I am not built for a pandemic. I am a I am a social creature.
Right, right.
You know, you mentioned before that you had the great advice about going into the banking business. Have you ever had any other mentors that have made a big difference, given you great advice along the way?
Oh, gosh. I've had so many extraordinary mentors in my life that I'm always reluctant to name a few. I always, though, want to say I came to First Tennessee Bank as a very young person with very few business skills. And when I say that, I had not focused on, I had taken theoretical classes in college, the econ classes and theory of money class. I had actually done a paper on finances in the Middle Ages, which prepared me for nothing but Trivial Pursuit. But what I did have, First Tennessee was an organization that was very focused on creating tools for people. And so they gave me an opportunity to go learn accounting. And they sent me to courses and graduate experiences that equipped me for many things in life. So I had many mentors there, including, as I said, my partner who I've worked with for almost my entire 42 years in banking directly. I've worked with him for the whole 42 years I've been in banking, but very directly with him for the vast majority of that time. And I would say he has been an extraordinary mentor. I would say that the entire management team at First Tennessee at the time had a real focus on trying to develop talent. And if you look around our city, many, many people who started at First Tennessee have had a chance to thrive in other financial institutions or in other businesses. I'd also like to say that my customers, who were extraordinary business people as well, have been mentors. I've had a chance to learn from some of the brightest and most disciplined and capable business leaders in our community by virtue of serving them and their financial needs. And that has been invaluable, to have a chance to see how people approach complex problems and solve them in various ways is really been wonderful. But I'd also say I was mentored first and foremost by two parents who were great believers in the possibility of everything that they believed their children could achieve. I had a second grade teacher who we were going around the class on a particular day, and teacher asked what everyone was going to be. And she asked me what I was going to be, and I said I was going to be a doctor. And so she said, oh, you mean a nurse? And I said, well, I guess I do, since you say so. And so I went home that night, and at dinner I mentioned that we had talked about it, and my teacher told me that I thought I was going to be a doctor, but she said I was going to be a nurse. And the following day, my father took me to school, which he never did, by the way. And he went to see my teacher, and he just said in a very kind but very firm way that I was going to be a doctor or an astronaut or a Supreme Court justice or president of the United States. I was going to be whatever I wanted to be. And he believed that as firmly as anyone could believe it, and it made me believe it as well. And then I had a mother who, my father passed away when I was very young. I was 16 years old. And my mother became the head of a household with young children. And she managed to somehow have a dinner with a green vegetable, a yellow vegetable, and a meat on the table every night and help us go to every sporting event and every program that we were participating in, and still balance making sure that we were financially stable. So I had mentors who both believed in me and then demonstrated how remarkably capable we are of doing very difficult things. And so I would say that's formative for anyone.
I love that. I was thinking about you when we were preparing for the podcast and thinking that how many other presidents of banks or co-founders of banks are female?
You know, the banking industry, and I say this all the time, banking industry is disproportionately female. About our workforce is
really?
About, yes, it is. You don't always notice that because in executive management, it's been male dominated. But in the city of Memphis, we have several female market executives, but we also have lots of women who are controlling big pieces of big organizations. And so there are not very many women, well, actually in the state of Tennessee and actually across the country, it's still rare enough that they talk about it. But I will tell you, and I've been doing this for a long time. I was very young when I had a chance to lead a financial organization. I was 37 years old, which is really unbelievable to me that someone thought that was a good idea. Because in retrospect, I thought I was completely ready. I know how much now I didn't know at the time. But what I would say is that what I've always believed about the opportunities that I've had as a female, that performance is really gender neutral. It becomes a matter of you are often exactly what you believe you are. And if you think that you are a banker first and then a female, you end up in a position where you're kind of dividing yourself up. And for me, it's always been, I didn't want to have to make choices about parts of my life that I had to sacrifice. So I have a sister who, when I was young, made a needlepoint pillow for me that said, you can have it all, you just can't sleep. And that's been sort of my theory, because when I was young and I have three children close together in age and a stepdaughter who I adore, so I've had a chance to I would not have ever considered sacrificing being a mother and as part of my whole journey. And at the time, my husband was also president of a local bank that he had started, and we would trade off at night after, when there wasn't remote technology, we would trade off at night, we would have dinner, we would put the kids to bed, and then one of us would go back to the office and work at night after hours so that we could make things work. But I've always believed that it's possible to do the things you really want to do. People always find a way to do the things they really want to do. And so I've focused less on my femaleness in the workplace, but in trying to figure out how to be a whole person in that process.
So if you could go back in time and give yourself some advice that you think would have been helpful, what would you do?
My gosh, there's so many things I got wrong, Jay. Thanks for asking.
And I will say that it's a privilege to ask the questions rather than have to answer them.
Right, I was going to say, I want to hear your answer for this, but I'll go ahead and answer. I'll say this. First of all, I would say life is messy, and what you have to learn how to do is survive the moment and clean up after yourself.
Yeah.
And I do think that is one of the things that I really want to get it right. I was an obnoxious student. I was very focused on having perfect scores and great grades. And what I've learned in life as I've gone along the way is that I've learned as much from the things that I didn't do well as from the things that I did do well. Quite frankly, I've probably learned more from the things that didn't turn out the way that I hoped they would. I would tell myself to be willing to fail, and to fail fabulously, and to fail fast. The real problem that we all probably have is we take too long to admit that just isn't going to work. As much as I want to will it to happen, it won't. I would also tell myself that the things that you can't undo, and there are many things in life that you can't undo, you have to find a way to take the good and that bad from that moment that is not perfect and messy, and manage to be better prepared for the next moment where you have a chance to get it right.
It's excellent advice for the young version of yourself and for everybody else.
Yeah, really. By the way, I'm the old version of myself. It's painfully obvious, and I would still say it's...
I didn't mean yeah.
No,
yeah,
no, 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 no. Actually, I lean into it now. I'm 62. I'll be 63 in March. And one of the things that I say all the time is I'm still learning. I have to still tell myself that same thing over and over again. I still have to be a little bit more forgiving. And I wish that I would also tell myself that don't forget to really enjoy the people that matter the most in your life. I've really tried really hard to do that. I have a family that is the world to me, but I also have dear friends. The real challenge is there are only 24 hours in a day, and you have to make wise choices about how you allocate those. And that's why I really don't sleep very much, because there's just not enough time.
True. There's not. Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Well, I see myself every day at the office in some version. So I don't know. I think that I'm not prepared for... I used to tell everyone I'm a writer when I was young. I always thought that at some point I would step away from my normal business activities and finish a novel that I started when I was very young. What I really think I will probably do in 5 years, though, is I hope that I'll be continuing to spend time with the people who are important to me. I have 6 grandchildren, and they are absolutely incredible. Everyone who tells you, the only thing in my adult life that has not been overrated is grandchildren. Everyone tells you they're fabulous. They're better than you could have possibly imagined. And because I loved my children so much, I couldn't imagine that there would be anything that would be just as fabulous. And I have to say, everyone's right. Grandkids are the thing, man. So I hope I'll be spending lots of time with them. And hopefully, maybe my goal in 5 years is, I think that having adventures with people that you love and creating memories is the most valuable thing that you can give to someone. Something where you say, let me share something that's really important to me, whether it's your favorite hiking trail somewhere in the mountains in East Tennessee, or some big landmark or monument somewhere in the world. I hope that that's part of what I'll be doing in 5 years, but I expect that I'll, in addition to that, be having a conversation about a next generation of iBankers.
Very good.
So one of the questions we like to ask everybody is, based on your experience and your knowledge, do you think that entrepreneurs are born or can they be taught?
It's an interesting question. And I will say that I believe that everyone can be taught to do things that don't come naturally to them, except for singing. And by the way, I've learned I can never learn how. So, and I know you're a musician, Jay, so I'll just say, yeah, I didn't get that. Wherever that gene is.
I don't have it either.
I would do it, man. I can try really hard, but I don't think it's going to happen for me. But what I do think is that there are people who are naturally disposed to seeing risk and opportunity and being able to overcome the fear of the risk to seize the opportunity. And in fact, I think that's the quote that I have for my Society of Entrepreneurs. I do think that entrepreneurs see risk and opportunity with equal clarity, but they just choose to embrace the opportunity. So I think that in the great scheme of things, people who are entrepreneurs, and think about in our community, we have such a rich history of producing risk takers. And I've, you know, theory after theory about how that happens and why that happens. I do think that there are places that promote that sense of possibility more than others. And I believe that there's a characteristic about our community, Memphis, that sort of helps support this entrepreneurial mindset, because we don't give up. We're like if there were a place or a group of people that would be the patron saints of second chances, it would be right here. We are always about, you know, this city nearly failed. It did fail and could have been wiped out from yellow fever and never have returned. And there's a quality about us that we just keep grinding, just like the Grizzlies. We're grit and grind. We're the people who come up with everything from the supermarket to Holiday Inn to FedEx to St. Jude Hospital. We are a place that is always going to say, if you've got a great idea and a commitment to making it happen, then we're going to listen to your story and we're going to, it sounds crazy, and sometimes the crazier it sounds, the more we like it. So
that is true.
So yeah. I say all the time, I think there is something extraordinary about this community, and I love the fact that we are actively seeking through Epicenter and initiatives that are all across our community to sort of help continue to inspire and support a next generation of entrepreneurs in all different areas. The things that people are thinking of today to make a business are as varied and as interesting and exciting as anything I've ever seen. And I think the pandemic, because we solve problems, is going to be a time when we are going to come up with yet another generation of fabulous new ideas out of this community, because we are people who hit walls and bounce back and look at the wall and decide how we're going to overcome it. We're going to paint it. We're going to drill through it. We're going to tunnel under it, or we're going to climb over it. And that's who we are. And I do think that it was, for me, Memphis was a place that absolutely embraced the idea that, well, sure, you can start a bank.
Right.
Absolutely. Go for it.
Mm-hmm. Love that. What excites you the most about Memphis? When you're thinking about somebody coming to Memphis, what do you want to make sure that you share and encourage them to know about?
Oh, man, I love Memphis so much. I actually have a process. I always take people on sort of a tour of our city when they come here for the first time. And I'll tell you that we always go to the river, because I think the river is sort of the lifeblood of who we are, and talk about what an extraordinary thing the river is. If you look at what we've done there, we built Mud Island. We took a place in the community that was actually just a sandbar, and we turned it into a neighborhood, and we built a pyramid downtown because we thought that was a great idea, and we turned it into a Bass Pro Shop. So I take people on that tour. I always stop by the Peabody. One of the very first things that happened when I came here, the Peabody was reopening, and I had a chance to be involved in, through First Tennessee, the idea of how we were going to have this public-private partnership to make something happen. So I love to show off the Peabody, because, you know, there are not many places where you can go in and see ducks swimming in a fountain. And I think that's a great place to go. I love our museums. But I will say that I'm always anxious to share our food, our entertainment, and always go by the National Civil Rights Museum, because I think that it's a really great place for us to pause and think about how all of us can be defined by, this was a hard thing that happened in our community at a really pivotal time in history, and we've been able to, as a community, take it and honor a moment to say, this is what it took to help bring us forward as a nation and as a people, and change has still got to come. But here's a place where we are actively looking at the hard things as well as the easy and exciting things, and reminding ourselves that, you know, we can always look up and look out and be a better version of ourselves than we've been before.
Some excellent insights. What do you like to do for fun, personally?
Well, I was actually having this conversation with my spouse before I came here. As I said earlier, I spend a lot of time with family and with my grandkids now, and that is redefining fun for me, because it's remarkable how entertaining giving a bath to an 18-month-old can be. And that experience of my grandkids, I spent a lot of time with family. I love to read. I read probably one fiction and one nonfiction book every 10 to 12 days. I read a lot and like to do that. I love to cook, believe it or not. And I love to eat, which is probably the two things go hand in hand. But I also, I'm interested in new ideas. And so this is going to sound so completely nerdy and wonky, but it's true. I love to listen to podcasts and TED Talks and people who have ideas because I'm inspired and I'm excited and entertained by all the above. But I really like being with my friends. I love good conversation and a lively exchange of ideas, which means I think a debate or an argument. But
so as you mentioned, books and podcasts, TED Talks, is there anything specific you would recommend to other entrepreneurs?
Well, certainly Entrepreneurial Insights, the podcast show right here today. Actually, those are really good. I'm a topical TED Talk listener, so I'll go look at things when I'm particularly interested in something or looking for an answer. And because of that, I tend to fall down the rabbit hole, Jay. So I could be like, I was looking at some information recently about resilience because I was going to do a talk about resilience. And I actually found that there's an entire science about resilience, what makes people resilient, how people rebound, who's likely to survive a disaster. So I literally spent about 4 days listening to lots of different podcasts and TED Talks from experts who help us understand what our psychology is. And I've learned some really fascinating things as a result. So if I recommend a TED Talk or a podcast to someone, it's probably not as exciting as if they are curious about something and go look for it themselves. But I do think, by the way, that curiosity is one of the single most important characteristics that a business person or an entrepreneur or, oh, a human being can have. So I tell people all the time that I think that that's really interesting. And I will say, in one of my recent TED Talks, I learned that there is a study that's been conducted by Harvard for the last 75 years plus on happiness. It's actually called human development, but it studied what makes people happy, survive. And they began in 1938 following a group of 724 men, of course, because it was 1938. They weren't interested in following a woman. And they followed them. And one of the things that they found is that the single thing that predicted likelihood of longevity is not your, this is a test that integrated medical test and professional success and followed their business careers. But the single thing that most predicted your longevity is whether you're happy with your primary relationship. So go be nice to your partner in life.
Fascinating. Yes, yes.
Very interesting. Well, and the one other question that we like to ask everybody is, besides faith, family, and friends, what are three things you cannot live without?
Okay. The question here is, shall I be honest?
Of course.
I'm actually trying to think of what advice I'm going to throw out as I answer this question. Actually, I will say, I can't live without, and this is besides my family, my faith, and my friends. That would have been my answer for the three. I'm going to say I can't live without a good book, a great idea, and a lively conversation.
There you go.
Well, and this has certainly been a lively conversation. So I think that's
actually, this has been a wandering in the wilderness, but thank you for that, that depiction of it all. Actually, I think what's interesting about this conversation is it's been a pleasure to be with you guys, but probably I should have remained more on point with regard to entrepreneurial issues, but it's been fun.
It's been very fun.
There's as much to learn about business as there is about personal stuff.
Well, there
so,
you go.
Yeah,
well,
I really appreciate you sharing everything.
Hey, listen, it's been a joy. Thank you.
This has been a lot of fun. Thank you, Susan, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to our episode with Susan Stevenson. If you want to learn more about Susan Stevenson or Independent Bank, you can find a link to the Society of Entrepreneurs profile in our show notes. Thanks for listening to Entrepreneurial Insights. If you enjoyed this conversation, feel free to share with your friends or colleagues. You can find more episodes or subscribe anywhere that you listen to your favorite podcasts. And of course, reviews are always welcome and appreciated. You can also check us out online at entrepreneurialinsightspodcast.com or bluffcitybusiness.com.